You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Community Radio for your city, Cambridge 105 FM. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours, but now at 12 p.m. it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly paddle about in the warm, welcoming waters of the latest cinema releases. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me this morning are Emma Martin.
Hi there.
Simon West.
Hello.
Kevin Hilton.
Hello.
And Mark Levisic.
Good afternoon.
Today's show either has an eye on the intimate or the immense. The Superman story gets a new lick of paint in enormous blockbuster Man of Steel, produced by Christopher Nolan, directed by Zack Snyder, and starring Henry Cavill as a Superman who must first battle his inner demons before taking on Michael Shannon's monstrous General Zod. There's more earth-shattering events in World War Z, with Brad Pitt's globe-trotting investigator all that stands between humanity and the growing zombie hordes. Meanwhile, at the other end of the dramatic scale, we have matters of the heart, with the interwoven romances of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing let loose in modern California in Joss Whedon's ambitious adaptation, and nearly 20 years after they first fell for each other, we catch up with Ethan Hawke's Jesse and Julia Delpy's Celine, seemingly perfect couple, in Before Midnight. Plus, as we head into the high season for UK film festivals, we look at the new kid on the block, the Suffolk Film Festival, which runs for 2 days in July. We spoke to the festival's director, Darren Metiner-Harvey, about the plans for the new festival, the films that have been submitted, and the role education and outreach is increasingly playing in the smaller festivals. But that's all to come, but we start the show with, is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's a trailer.
What if a child dreamed of becoming something other than what society had intended?
I have to believe that you were sent here for a reason. And even if it takes the rest of your life, you owe it to yourself to find out what that reason is.
You will give the people of Earth an ideal to strive towards. In time, you will help them accomplish wonders.
You believe your son is safe?
I will find him!
My father believed that if the world found out who I really was, they'd reject me. He was convinced that the world wasn't ready. What do you think?
Comic book movies on the big screen hasn't been an easy translation. What works on the page can easily seem utterly ridiculous with actual actors and costumes and the dialogue freed from speech bubbles. Marvel Studios, home to Iron Man and the Avengers, have embraced the form. Confident, strong characters will pull the audience along into the ridiculous, whilst DC Comics have opted for the Batman of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight films. Grounded in reality, the bright colours drained away to reveal the base metal underneath. New release Man of Steel is a Superman film partially designed to sit in the same naturalistic world as Nolan's Batman films, though that effect is then rather undercut by having the ostentatious stylist Zack Snyder directing. The film opens on the dying planet of Krypton, where Russell Crowe's scientist Jor-El sends his newborn son into space to avoid the coming catastrophe. The life pod takes the infant, Kal-El, to Earth, where he is discovered and brought up by an honest Kansas farming family played by Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. Now christened a more human-sounding Clark Kent, the young man struggles to find his place in a world that isn't his own and cope with burgeoning superpowers that terrify him. Emma, everybody's seen this, and imagine it'll be quite a lively debate. But to start with you, Man of Steel is an attempt to right a valuable franchise after the perhaps unfair failure of 2006's Superman Returns. Did this new film have you cheering for the big blue boy scout?
That I like that, the phrasing. Yeah, I think one of the things I did like about this film, because I think I'm going to be sitting somewhere in the middle of this discussion, was Henry Cavill's performance. So I was cheering for him. I thought he was excellently cast. So he makes a good Superman. The first half has some really good-looking moments in, I think, particularly the flashbacks. The flashbacks to Kansas, I think, are dealt with, you know, visually really quite beautifully. I have seen 300, but I didn't see Zack Snyder's second one. So from that point of view, yes, there are things to like about it. Cheer, I'm not sure, because really the whole film kind of just sinks under the weight of maybe its own seriousness and its own portentousness, and then it just disintegrated, for me anyway, to a second half of complete, I don't know, the story wasn't particularly clear to me. The fight scenes just seemed to go on forever and were super tedious for me. And I didn't think, there was no sass, there was no levity, there was no, the chemistry between Amy Adams as Lois Lane and Henry Cavill as Superman was disappointing, because they are performers that I rate, particularly, you know, Amy Adams, I've seen a lot of things, really like her, and I felt, I don't know if she was underwritten or underused or what it was, but she just didn't quite take off. And it just felt like a kind of sense that there was, yeah, just a sense of such seriousness about it that the enjoyment wasn't there. And I found myself quite nostalgic for the Richard Donner films by the end of it, I think.
Mark, there is a case here that as Emma's pointed out, this sass is a good way of putting it. It's not a particularly fun film in the Superman mold. It's a fun film for other reasons, perhaps, but whilst it doesn't follow the Dark Knight route of filling the character with angst, it does replace this big blue boy scout, as he's known, with this character who suddenly, in the time-honored tradition of recent blockbusters, has to become something, that he has something to fulfill. And you, Kevin Costner's Pa Kent says to him, you have to decide the man you're going to be, which is not dissimilar to the Spider-Man movie of last year. And it's not something that's been dealt with terribly in classic Superman. And I felt that perhaps it was distancing itself from the comic books by putting it from the comic book sensibility by putting too much of this of meaning into it.
It has sort of become trapped between trying to reinvent itself and trying to lay out that sort of mythology, and ultimately I think it just then gets sucked into a big black hole because of it. The mythologizing just doesn't work in the sense of trying to create an almost Jesus-like figure from Superman. It's an odd thing when actually the whole Superman mythology is probably more Moses than it is Jesus. But either way, there's no harm in the intent of going out to try and set out something like that. And the first half of the film does set up an awful lot of interesting questions. The second half of the film ignores all of them completely and throws things at buildings for an hour. And that's the big frustration for me, that it actually, if it had followed through on the promise of the first half, it could have been a great film. And it just wasn't. And as Emma says, that lack of levity, even the Batman films, you know, which are the comparison, are actually filled with a fair amount of humour. This is about as dry as a four-week-old cream cracker. It's horrible in places. There's two or three jokes near the end, and I was ready to rip my hair out by the end of it in just sheer frustration at the missed opportunity.
Simon, you feel differently, but do you feel, before we get into what you like, do you feel that Mark's point that the questions it raises in the very talkative, flashback-filled first half go anywhere in the second half, and it just descends into fights, as cool as those fights may or may not be?
No, I think it does seem to answer a lot of the questions, and, you know, it does actually go towards, I mean, the one word I use to sum this film up is epic. It's, you know, it is long, it has got long talking bits, but it really does ground all the characters into a more realistic world, which is what they're trying to do, rather than just having the bumbling Clark Kent and Lois Lane always failing to recognise him just before he got the glasses. So they don't have any of that ridiculousness. It is, you know, a great story led by a lot of great performances. You know, we've already mentioned Henry Cavill. I thought Amy Adams was fine. And then you got his father's, the Robin Hood's...
the two Robin Hoods, I hadn't thought about
that.
Yeah,
Russell Crowe and Kevin Costner. we need to see more Kevin Costner and things, because he was just absolutely fantastic. Like I said, you really did get a chance to invest in all the characters. And then, you know, I'm not quite sure why, but you're complaining about the fight scenes. But these, again, epic is the words of the fight scenes. These are major superheroes. They destroy the whole town. There's no holding back. I've can't think of any film recently which has had, you know, destruction of fights on this scale, which should be what you expect from characters of this.
I think it's not so scale so much as the repetition of the building of the scenes. I there's two fights in the second half. There's not much action in the first half, which is fine. I'm not looking for that sort of action. But there's one fight in Smallville when General Zod and his accomplices come. I enjoyed that because it used the surroundings and there were interesting moments. By the time it gets to Zod and Superman fighting in the skyscrapers in scenes that oddly turn from day to night, from inhabited cities to desolate wastelands, I just felt it was just punching into buildings. They weren't doing anything. It's fun to watch, but in the end, it's just Superman fighting particle system effects. I wasn't engaged with the characters. He didn't have anything to prove. And that's the problem with the fights. It's not the epic quality of them, it's the repetition and the fact they don't have any narrative point after the Smallville fight. I want to bring Kevin in because Kevin, Simon had a good point before we went on air that maybe you can't voice an opinion on this one because you didn't see all of it, but I'm intrigued why, for the first time ever on Bums on Seats, a reviewer walked out of a film and you walked out of Man of Steel.
I did. Well, the Richard Donner movie is one of my favourite films of all time. And so I'm probably... hard to be impartial with this new one. Superman Returns I was indifferent with. So I'm only going to review the first hour or so that I saw, so that's what my opinion's totally based on. But none of it that I saw had any logic to it whatsoever. Narratively, you know, when you read sort of books on script writing, you think every scene should be progressing the plot, at least should make sense. And there just seems to be none of it. I'm thinking of, like, in the original, the first sort of half an hour where you sort of see Superman as a boy growing up on Smallville is, I think, as perfect as sort of 30, 40 minutes as you can possibly get. And it's so sort of moving and human. And you see him as... The idea of Superman's parents was always to be that he came from sort of super stock, didn't know who he was, and his Earth parents literally sort of, you know, ground him in and mould him to be a good... Humanised him. Which you see really well because in... the original, he's sort of showing off his skills. He's chasing him back from, like, the football field, all the bullies and stuff. And his dad sort of explains, you know, you can't just use it just to show off, essentially. In this one, you see a scene early on. He's, like, 12 years old. He's being bullied on a bus. I hope this isn't a spoiler. Saves the bus full of drowning kids and then goes back and rescues the bully. It seems to be that he's already good without the help of his parents. He is...
In fact, they're having to pull him back from being so good.
So good, yeah. And he keeps saying, you got to be good. He's like, I'm already good. And it sort of seemed to make...
And there's inconsistencies there, because Pa Kent, Jonathan Kent, Kevin Costner's character, says to him, the line I quoted earlier, you have to decide what man you're going to be. And then we cut to one of the flashbacks, the scene where we lose Jonathan, Pa Kent in the tornado, where they're having an argument about whether Clark wants to work on the farm when he grows up. Where's the logic in any of this?
I'm glad you said that. I wasn't sure if that was going to be a spoiler. And that was another thing that is dad being taken away.
That's one of the worst scenes of 2013.
It's so terrific in the first film when his dad passes away from a heart attack. It's something that he cannot say.
Exactly.
And it's so... That in itself made him human in a way that you couldn't do narratively over... And these guys couldn't do it over sort of 2 hours or whatever this movie was. Do you know what I mean? And he could have saved his dad in this one, and he just didn't. And that town already broadly knows that this kid's got superpowers. Well, so location sort of is already kind of aware from the things he's done growing up.
Not only broadly knows, but isn't this supposedly more realistic approach? The whole town knows he's got superpowers. Not one of them feels the need to go and tell anyone about this. They'll just implicitly keep his secret.
But is this the bigger problem that and I don't want to sideline Simon and liking the film, but it cause that wouldn't be fair. And Emma found things to enjoy in the film, so I don't want to completely throw weaponry at the film.
As did I the first half. So.
But this is a problem with Zack Snyder's approach with the films he's done before, Sucker Punch, which I know Simon and I had a big argument about, discussion about, is that everything is more. It's the phrase or line from Frasier, if you start with a more, imagine how much more will be. It's Pa Kent dying in the first Superman. Don't mimic that. But even taking away the narrative importance of having his Earth father die of a heart attack, something he can't stop, just throwing a whole tornado into this is just... Why? It doesn't, and you don't even treat the tornado realistically. You have him stand Kevin Costner standing up in the tornado waiting to be swept away. No, that doesn't happen. You can't do that. So either be realistic or be a comic book. Don't be this halfway house between the two. Sorry.
And is there not the problem? I mean, the essential problem with Superman is, of course, he is Superman. So it's not, you know, he doesn't have any... You know, the whole theory is, the whole premise behind him is he doesn't have vulnerabilities other than, of course, if he's attacked by Krypton, I guess.
Which they don't have in this film.
So that makes it difficult. And that, I think, goes back to, yes, okay, epic fight scene, whatever, but it's just watching two people with no vulnerabilities for 10 minutes or whatever. It felt like 10 minutes is probably only about a 2-minute fight scene, but it just felt like forever. And I think that's, when you say Zack Snyder puts more is more, that's a problem. You don't need more with Superman as a character. You've got to try and find the ways to find the vulnerability, which is, much as Simon might have said, you know, the whole cheesy Clark Kent, Lois Lane thing in the Richard Donner movies, it worked because he was very vulnerable as Clark Kent. And obviously, you know, maybe if this does kickstart a franchise, which it might well do, because I believe it's, you know, the money it's making is phenomenal, so yeah. I can't imagine they're not going to make a second one. Maybe they will, you know, there will be more of that kind of Clark Kent side of things, but it's hard to empathise with someone so completely invulnerable, and that was my other
point. But they did introduce a vulnerability into him, which was, you know, the greatest part of this film. Is Superman is a notoriously difficult character to get right because he is so invulnerable. There is no danger, there's nothing. But they really gave him such, you know, through personality, the vulnerable heart, and you know, his love for the, you know, the humans, which just come through. I mean, the fight scene, you may say, yeah, it's two invulnerable people fighting each other, but that creates the interest because it's like, well, how is it going to crack? One of them's going to have to crack, and otherwise it's just like, yeah, Superman's going to win. But it's like, how's it going to play out? You don't know.
All right, let's discuss how that plays out. Everybody's... The end of this film, and I don't mind talking about that because I imagine everybody's going to see this film has already seen it, and this has been widely discussed in the press, features the death of millions.
Yeah.
In a Superman film where he... jaunts off. They give a sort of rough logical reason for it. He jaunts off to the other side of the world to deal with a special effect, and he leaves. And again, the film gets carried away with its own preposterousness. It has this really rather wonderful effect of this reshaking the Earth's magnetic core. You've not seen this, Kevin? It's brilliant. But it's a neat effect, and they get carried away with it, and it kills hundreds and hundreds of people in a Superman film. He's not there to do anything. Even Superman Returns has him saving people during the earthquake with little things. In this, he just lets them all die, and then he kills Zod at the end, and which, again, is not something Superman would do. Now, I'm not into keeping things strictly within canon, but it seems to me Superman Returns is a flawed film, but it has moments of quiet, and it likes Superman. This struck me as a film made by people who didn't care they were making a Superman film. They were just wanted a franchise starter.
I'm just coming on that ending. The thing that made me angry about Superman killing Zod wasn't that Superman killed Zod. I see no problem with reimagining a mythology that put something fresh onto that spin. My problem with it was there's no consequences afterward. There was an interview with David Goyer this week where he said that that was the lesson that taught Superman that killing was wrong. That's not what I took from the film. I took from the film that it's fine for Superman to kill whoever he wants as long as he can kill them. He shows no remorse afterwards. He's going around knocking drones out of the sky. There's no consequence. That was the fundamental problem with the ending, which made me very angry.
Which happened about 5 minutes before the end of the film, leading up to the sequel, where it probably is going to be investigated the fact that he did kill off everybody from his own race. It's major impact, which is why they did it.
But is it dramatic? Is it too generically dramatic? I think that's the problem. They've taken the things that made, as we've pointed out, Superman is an awkward case. Yep. His invulnerability makes him a fairly uninteresting hero.
Yeah.
Unless you're just interested in special effects. So they've taken away those invulnerabilities in the normal, they've not dealt with them in the way that the first film dealt with them with the idea that he can't stop human mortality. He can't stop the human clock ticking away. Mm. And they've given them these more generic, more blockbuster friendly tropes in many respects that does link him to the Dark Knight and does link him to other superheroes. And I just felt it didn't have a place in a Superman film. It was too ordinary, I think. That was my problem with it. In the end, he was just too ordinary.
No, I mean, I can't really see where, you know, how you can actually say he was ordinary. He's, you know, more lifelike, more realistic. I can't really, you know, say how it's ordinary. I mean, it is a darker film. It's not trying to copy the other two films. It is moving forward. I think there was plenty in the plot and you know, narration beforehand, leading up with the themes of genocide and continuation of race and all of that, which is what led up to the final battle with Zod. I mean, you could see, if you actually follow the story, you could see what the impact was beyond just killing the bad guy. You know, he killed the last man, you know, the last of the person from his race.
Yes.
So you can, you know, I can see from the acting that, you know, it is a big deal, and that's what he has to deal with. Yeah, I mean, millions die at the end of the, you know, scene. He's on the side of the world trying to save it. It's, you know, it's a big war between races. It's, you know, collateral damage happens. And it happened on a big scale here because the fight scenes were on a massive scale.
Do you think in the end, I think, ignoring all the problems that everybody else has, in the end, my main beef with it was until Lois Lane is forced to go into the General Zod spacecraft, mm-hmm. when they pick Superman up and they say she has to come with us. That was the first moment, that's about an hour or so in, where I thought, well, this is new. Because everything else, however beautifully photographed it is, and it is, and it looks good, and it's edited well, and the music, Hans Zimmer's score, is fantastic, and the acting's fine. That was the first time it did anything that was unexpected, that I hadn't seen a dozen times before. Should they have started somewhere else? I think as a final point, and to end with you, Simon, because I want to end on a positive point, and I don't feel like you've been bullied by us all. But perhaps they could have taken this exact approach, but started later, rather than having the origin again.
I don't know. I quite like the fact that the origin they had was more Krypton-based and different. And although, you know, it was an origin, it was a new origin. They didn't do the growing up on a farm, because that had been done before. It's been done in Smallville. These have all been expressed before. But to actually do it more as an adult finding himself and then having flashbacks, I thought was different, interesting, and a unique way to approach the character, which made it a lot more interesting to see, you know, how the character would develop.
Okay, all right. Well, we could obviously speak for the entire hour on this, but I don't think that'd be much fun for everybody else listening. Okay, thank you, everybody. Man of Steel opened last Friday and is screening at every single one of the three Cambridge cinemas, both in 2D and 3D versions. I saw 2D on
2D.
3D, I can't imagine that punching through people through buildings in 3D. It is a Certificate 12A. It is often pointed out that proof of William Shakespeare's genius is how effortlessly his work adapts to any genre or style. American High School, the glamorous musical, feudal Japan, outer space, the Balkan battlefield, all have happily become Shakespearean. Previous screen versions of Much Ado About Nothing, however, have kept strictly to the play's sunny Sicilian setting, except the latest version, released last week and adapted and directed by Joss Whedon, which places the romantic comedy of lies and misunderstandings in the palatial surroundings of a Californian house and garden. Alexis Denisov stars as Benedict, honest companion to his commander Don Pedro and fellow soldier Claudio. The three, weary after a battle to capture Don John, Don Pedro's errant brother, are welcomed into the hilltop home of the convivial Leonardo. The house overflows with romance, with the maids pairing themselves off with the eager soldiers and Claudio head over heels in love with Leonardo's daughter, Hero. The bachelor Benedict gently mocks Claudio's youthful passion, naming love a distraction for the naive, but he himself masks a burning desire for Hero's cousin, the beautiful Beatrice, played by Amy Acker.
It is certain I am loved of all ladies, for truly, I love none.
Dear happiness to women. Put your hands
together one time. Oh, God, sir. I cannot endure my lady tongue.
There's a kind of merry war betwixt Signor Benedict and her. They never meet, but there's a skirmish of wit between them.
If you three will minister assistance,
I will bring Signor Benedict and the Lady Beatrice into a mountain of affection.
By this day, she's a fair lady.
Are the only love gods.
I want you to get together. I want you to get together.
Simon, back down to earth. Rather than a surprise collaboration, the rapid-fire wit of Much Ado About Nothing seems, on paper at least, to be a natural fit for the writer of Buffy and Serenity and the Avengers last year. Is it a match that pays dividends?
Oh, yes, definitely. this film was just delightful. I mean, I've been looking forward to one for a long, long time, mainly because I'm a big fan of Joss Whedon and everything else, and the history, I think, is just as interesting. It's actually, like I said, it's the history behind the film that they made, rather than, you know, necessarily the films themselves, where it's a group of actor friends who used to do Shakespeare every weekend. He had a 12-day gap, so he made an entire film in his house, and what a magnificent house it is. It's, like I said, it's just delightful from start to finish. I mean, it's all in Shakespearean language, so it's, you know, kept that quite faithful, which meant I did have my usual problem with Shakespeare, where it takes me half an hour just to actually gather what's actually going on. But it is so funny, it's witty. Alexis Denisov and Amy Acker are just fantastic as Beatrice and Benedict, bouncing off each other. It's absolutely wonderful. It's, you know, it's just a film full of absolutely great thespians doing a really amusing and, you know, well-shot and fantastic Shakespearean play.
Mark, script aside, which is obviously just about flawless, as Simon just said, it was just shot by Joss Whedon in his the home his wife designed for the two of them over 12 days. It features familiar faces from Joss Whedon's television programs,
and films,
Dollhouse and Buffy and things like that, and the music's by Joss Whedon and his wife. That's all wonderful, but does it come across too much as a home movie or a sort of fancy Shakespeare in the Park, in that, because Whedon, even at his best, is not the most charismatic of directors. He's a great writer, but not the most charismatic of directors.
I will say that it did take me about 10-15 minutes to stop looking at the decor of Joss Whedon's house and thinking, oh no, wouldn't have put that there, rather than actually focusing on the characters in the script. So I had to step back from it a little to start with. I think it does serve it well by giving it a sort of compact feeling, by keeping it in the one setting, just occasionally popping across the road to the sort of police setup they got. It keeps the drama grounded in that sense. I think the one thing it does struggle with slightly is the sense of drama. I think that you get a mix of the comedy, the romance, and the drama throughout the course of the narrative, and I think the drama is probably the weakest of those three, probably because of the way that Whedon has staged it. I think the comedy works brilliantly. I think they are a talented group of comedic performers, and that comes across very well. And I actually think the romance, not only the romance between Amy Acker and Alex Denisov, but also the other romance in the film, also are strong and you know, do exactly what they're designed to do. I think it's just a shame that maybe Whedon's directorial style is slightly exposed by the setting and the drama, and that's where it could have done with a little more expansion, a little more scope, just to really bring it to life and match the level of the other two.
Just some interesting shots. I find his camera placement and the way he blocks scenes very quite clumsy. I found it clumsy on the Avengers as well. But praising him in other departments.
The other thing that did seem slightly odd is that it felt very much almost like a home movie. There's points when it seems like they've not done any ADR, they've not done any other sort of finishing touches to up the film. Because Amy Acker's under the counter and you can't hear what she's saying as she's getting up. She's obviously not near enough the microphone. So it does almost have a very home movie feel, and you're quite sure whether that's intentional or not. In the end, thankfully, it doesn't detract too much from the overall experience.
Simon, Joss Whedon has made, whilst he's not adapted the text, as he said, every syllable in the film is Shakespeare's, he's helped by a little bit, but it's one of the few plays that's not an iambic, so it's prose, so it helps the actors as well. But he has changed certain sequences around to deal with the sexual politics of Much Ado About Nothing. It's a romantic comedy. As Joss Whedon says, it's one of the first romantic comedies, but at the same time, it pulls the romantic comedy apart and distrusts it. Hero, as a character who, let's say, is a 17, 18-year-old girl in the story, her father wishes her dead when the rumour is revealed that she might have slept with somebody. Whedon paints it so she was unfaithful to her fiance. In the play, it's more the fact that she's lost her virginity that makes it a disgrace. He downplays all of that. Do you think he manages to make the sexual politics in the play are confrontational, but he sort of waters that down a little bit too much, plays it too safe, makes it too family friendly in a way?
I don't really know, to be honest. I've got no familiarity with the original play. I did not know the story beforehand. I haven't studied it at all.
But how does he deal with the female protagonist? Because they're familiar. Amy Acker's character Beatrice could be a Buffy character.
Yeah, I thought Hero is probably the weakest of the bunch because she didn't seem to really have any personality, and she almost just seemed to be MacGuffin there. It was a shame because compared to Franz Kran's character, who yet again absolutely stole almost every scene he was in, and he should be in a lot more things. It's hard to say. It was dated. The whole fuss about it, whether she was unfaithful or impure, as we were saying. It is very dated, but it is Shakespearean. It's the kind of thing you say. Apparently he did change a couple of racial slurs in this as well.
He took some of the anti-Semitic humour out,
which he changed in here, so he did change a few things. But when the whole rumour and, the besmirching of the character is all based on her fidelity, you think, yes, that's a bit out of time. The whole idea of all of that and you must ask my dad whether I can marry her without even actually having the two parties even talking to each other.
It's almost an arranged marriage.
It's anachronistic, it's dated, but this is an adaptation of a Shakespeare play. So you've got to take it as part of that.
Things would be different in the Jacobean era. All right, we're going to wrap it up there so we can keep moving on. Much Ado About Nothing opened last Friday and is screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A.
Advertising your business is our business. For more details, call Cambridge 967 105 or email sales@cambridge105.fm. Stand out and get noticed with Cambridge 105.
In Your Company is Cambridge 105's business programme, presented by me, Sam Davis. In Your Company tries to capture the diversity of the Cambridge business scene by talking to not only the high-tech headline grabbers, but also the sole traders and the startups and the experts who can help us make sense of it all. You can listen to In Your Company at 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons every fortnight, and podcasts of all our shows are available on the Cambridge 105 website. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Text us on 07919 070 490 or email studio@cambridge105.fm.
We are your Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 FM, community radio for your city. With ironic timing, now that summer has finally arrived, we're being beckoned into the dark by the new film festival season. Cannes got the ball rolling last month, closely followed by Sheffield's Documentary Film Festival, and in the past week by Edinburgh's International Film Festival. But every film festival has to start somewhere, and next month sees the inaugural Suffolk Film Festival, which takes place in Ipswich. Running from the 11th to the 13th of July and spread across three venues, the long weekend is a careful first step into cinematic festivals for a region of East Anglia hardly ever mentioned in glowing cultural terms. I spoke to the festival's founder and director, Daniel Metiner-Harvey, about what the short celebration of film is comprised of, the role played by education and outreach, and the amateur filmmaking landscape in Ipswich and the surrounding area. But he began by explaining the film festival's roots.
I'd been thinking about it for a few years, but never kind of had the right group with me. And it was kind of a group of students that said, wow, that would be a fantastic idea. We don't have anything like that in Ipswich. And so kind of started, putting down some plans and thinking, could this happen? Let's just go for it. So although it's kind of been 2 years, it's actually been only 6 months that we've been actively working on it.
What was the approach to this particular film festival? Your website says nothing over 40 minutes, I believe, so it's very much a short film festival, is that correct?
We wanted to keep it to short films. We thought big from day one. It was always about, let's make it kind of as big as possible. Let's just kind of do it. And it was a grand title and a grand idea. We had to kind of then come back down to earth and realise that it's a first year. And, not knowing the film festival kind of scene too much, had to do a lot of research. I've got a couple of friends down at the Colchester Film Festival that run that festival, and they were great in imparting a lot of advice. And now it's a really comfortable position where we're going to have nice, fairly low-key 3 days. We've got some good guest speakers. We've had Some fantastic films submitted, about 400 films so far, and you know, a few that were kind of showed at Cannes. So, you know, we're really proud of kind of where it's headed this year.
When you scratch the surface, what is the non-professional filmmaking environment before the group that you formed and other groups came along? Because I've lived in Cardiff, I've lived in Bristol, I currently live in Cambridge, and they all have filmmaking groups and access to equipment. Is that something that Ipswich was missing, or something that just needed to be made a bit more cohesive, perhaps?
There wasn't an awful lot that there was, certainly as far as I was aware, you know, any kind of societies or groups that actively got together and, you know, worked collaboratively on projects, on films. And what this festival is doing, it's starting to bring filmmakers together in the area. And there's a fantastic project actually in the area called Recreate. It's being launched. There's people talking about it now, and it's kind of being launched in the autumn. And the idea behind that, it's the local council, various kind of colleges and establishments, institutions getting together and saying, look, we need to kind of be doing more with the arts in the town. So there's kind of going to be funding going into it, areas of the town allocated to kind of like a media centre, etc.
What are the categories that you've broken the submissions into, and how are you running the screenings over that? There's 2 days, isn't there? And then there's an extra day, a day later, which is the best of the fest.
Yeah, there's going to be the 2 days that will take place at Suffolk One. The Thursday is a kind of a day that we're inviting local schools in. So they're going to send some students, some kind of media and film students in, and they're going to make a film in a day. With kind of support of the team at Suffolk One. And then the evening is going to kind of be an emerging talent evening, where we'll be celebrating all the student category that is out there, as well as the kind of local student submissions. We're celebrating that with screenings of their films and then awards. The Friday will be a workshop day with kind of various people coming in. We've got Stephen Hall coming in and a guy called Sash, who's a short filmmaker. And it's going to be workshops to kind of college level students. And then the evening will be the kind of film festival awards. And all day on the Friday, we're also going to have the auditorium. It seats about 200. That's going to be showing the short films that have been kind of shortlisted for the festival. And then on the Monday, we're going to have a 2-hour screening at Cineworld Ipswich. And then the following Monday, we're also going to have another 2-hour screening at Cineworld Ipswich.
I've noticed that the smaller festivals are leaning as heavily towards education as they are to the films they show. Saffron Screen, which is the cinema in Saffron Walden, they had a festival last year, which was a lot of films, but also workshops, animation workshops, as your festival is doing. This outreach, this making film festivals seem less exclusive, more inclusive, is something that's moving forwards, because obviously Colchester does it, you do it.
I think, you know, it's really, really important. And from day one, it kind of formed the backbone of, you know, our idea that it was always about kind of celebrating the grassroots. And then, you know, alongside, you know, kind of, you know, practice filmmakers, It was kind of always about that. And I think it's really important if you look at, you know, a really big hitter like Sundance, and, you know, they're very commercial now, and, you know, it's very exclusive. And some of the big festivals that, you know, you kind of have to pay a lot to submit a film and to attend, is out of a lot of kind of young people's reach. I think it's really, really important. And I think that in order for the smaller festivals to survive, and maybe even to be taken seriously, they do need to have these outreach programs where they are making links with community, they are making links with local schools, even at kind of primary level, to create a buzz in first and foremost your local area.
The filmmaking production model changed so drastically over the last 10 years. The festival model has to change to mirror that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely has to, you know, in order to survive.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Daniel for finding the time for the interview. The Suffolk Film Festival begins on Thursday, July the 11th and finishes on the 13th. For more information, both on the festival schedule for both screenings and workshops, but also if you feel you'd like to help out as a volunteer at the festival, then please visit their website, which is www.suffolkfilmfestival.com. They are also to be found on Twitter and Facebook. Just run a simple search for Suffolk Film Festival. You were listening to Bums on Seats with me, Toby Miller, and reviewers Emma Marchant, Simon West, Kevin Hilton and Mark Livesich. As always, this show is just the midway point through a very full day on Cambridge 105. We'll be followed by Radio Dante. At 2 p.m. is Arts Roundup, and then at 3 p.m. the station heads outdoors for the third of our summer Saturdays, reporting today for the Midsummer Fair and Fen Edge Festival. Then at 6, the station falls into music with Club Global, Two Tone and the Graham Park Radio Show. That's all to come in 20 or so minutes. We'll wrap up with Bums on Seats with the end of the human race in World War Z, but before that, we're taking what's supposed to be a romantic break in Greece.
We say we were going to stop. They wanted to see the ruins.
Yeah, but should we wake them up?
No.
You know what, let's do? On our way back to the airport, we can catch them.
You know we won't.
Yeah, I'm probably not.
Okay.
And how did you two meet?
We met about 18 years ago. We kind of, sort of, fell in love. And a decade later, we ran into each other.
No. You wrote a book, and I read about it and went to look for it.
Oh, that's pretty romantic.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you start talking to me? Would you ask me to get off the train with you?
Of course. You
never stop ogling girls.
I don't ogle girls. I make love to them with my eyes.
Oh, wow. I'm stuck with an American teenager.
Why am I finding myself so attracted to this woman?
It's not often the Hollywood love story lingers. The first kiss is documented in hours and hours of film, but once a movie relationship is consummated, the camera tends to lose interest, not wanting to ruin the perfect moment with reality. Set in Europe, but directed by an American, Texan Richard Linklater, 1994's Before Sunrise and 2005's Before Sunset are an attempt to throw a more naturalistic light on love. In Before Sunrise, Ethan Hawke's Jesse, a backpacking American, met Julie Delphi's Celine, a Parisian student. They sense a connection in the brief time they're together, but end the film turning back to their own lives. Before Sunset captures the two again, this time older, a bit wiser, and possibly choosing to stay together. The much-anticipated Before Midnight, released yesterday, completes the trilogy, catching up with Jesse and Celine as they cross into their 40s and their relationship settles into its 18th year. Ninth year. Ending a long summer holiday in Greece, they have a rare day to themselves, and bubbling tensions start to rise to the surface. Mark, Before Midnight has been highly anticipated by critics who have grown up with the burgeoning romance of Jesse and Celine, but you were a latecomer to the trilogy.
Yes, I actually managed to watch all three of them yesterday, possibly thanks to it being the longest day of the year and possibly thanks to me being slightly insane. It's a remarkable effect when you watch all three one after the other, of seeing them literally age before your eyes.
Like the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yes, it's just it's slightly slower. Another 7 or 8 of those, and I think we'll be there. But I will hold my hand up and say that I adored all three of them for different reasons in each case. It's interesting watching the three of them together because, in a way, they actually reflect off each other. There are almost bits of foreshadowing and looking forward to the future in Before Sunrise. And it's Before Sunset is looking both back and forwards, even in its short running time. What they do all absolutely capture is the feeling of intruding on a real couple's relationship. It absolutely feels the most human, the most real relationship I think I've ever seen on Committed to Celluloid. A lot of that's got to be down to Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, who are both absolutely fantastic and managed to take Before Midnight in new ways but keep the characters feeling consistent. You get hints at the flaws in their characters in the first two films. These flaws are absolutely brutally laid bare in this film. Neither is by any means a perfect character, but they always absolutely feel like two genuine characters, and it's a fascinating journey.
Emma, you're on record as having trouble not being able to abide the first film at all.
Really couldn't.
But you really enjoyed this threequel.
Nice. I haven't quite worked out why that is. It could have come from a lingering dislike for Ethan Hawke all those years ago, which now I seem to have overcome because obviously I've matured and mellowed and can appreciate good acting when I see it. I don't know. I think actually that before Sunrise, I found interminably kind of pretentious. I found dialogue pretentious, and then I hated that so much. I never watched Before Sunset until yesterday, and then I watched Before Sunset before going to see Before Midnight. And Before Sunset is very short, and I enjoyed that much more than I thought I would do. And then Before Midnight, I guess, you know, I am the same age as this couple. I also have twins. I could think I'm not quite perhaps as coming to the end of a delightful six-week holiday, or not so delightful as maybe in Greece. But the reality in this couple, I think, is really true. It is a snapshot. It's very much, it's not quite real time, but, and the first half introduces many more characters than you've had in any of the other films. The other films have been very much just the Jesse and Celine characters. This, you have a whole kind of first half where they're hanging out with their other friends and compatriots at this Greek guest house. But this idea that they're really, that she even says, Julie Delpy's character says, you know, she really doesn't want to do the hotel thing, as she calls it. They know that they have this hotel room booked for them by these friends, and she's aware of the kind of tensions that obviously are bubbling to the end of the service. At the end of a summer holiday, he's had to send his son back to his ex-wife in America that he has obviously a very horrible relationship. This is Ethan Hawke, not necessarily. So there's all these tensions coming up, but they have to do it anyway. And that kind of idea of being forced romance as a couple who've been together for 10 years and you are away from the children, so you will enjoy yourself, and it just never works out that way, just rang so true to me. And from that point of view, I really, really enjoyed it. And I'll say, I sat here in this seat and panned This Is 40 beyond belief. And this is effectively, if you boil it down, the same thing. It's affluent white American, well, in this case American and French, in that case two Americans, with, you know, what really in the scheme of things are very small problems. I hated This Is 40, but I really found a lot to enjoy in this.
Simon, this is Before Midnight is the longest of the three films, and it's the most ambitious, as Emma's just said, in terms of characters. But you came in this morning and said you didn't feel it was long enough, that you could have continued watching.
It wasn't long enough, no. I haven't seen the Before Sunrise and Before Sunset since they came out in the cinema. Even so, I remember liking those films. I couldn't remember anything about it. So this was actually pretty fresh for me, rather than the people who've just watched it, watch the old ones to catch up. But I absolutely loved it. I wasn't as keen as the other characters that they introduced. They did introduce a lot, but I thought a lot of them were almost all too pretentious when they were all combined, and it was almost a little bit too unrealistic that all the similarities and what they're discussing. Although, to be honest, it's quite amusing what they're discussing about the relationships and how to interact, and you've got a young couple, an older couple, and, you know, the middle couple. But when Jesse and Celine just start walking to the hotel and it's just by themselves chatting to each other again, it's just like the magic is there. The romance, it is just absolutely wonderful. You had the arguments in the hotel, which, although it sounds really bad about the, you know, you can see them breaking apart and the arguments, it is also so funny. Everyone was laughing so much in the cinema I was in. It was, you know, it was, I used it before, it was delightful. It was, you know, it was real, it was harsh, it was funny, like these things can be. And towards the end of the film, I was thinking, no idea of the time, I thought they're going to go off and do another long wander around the streets together at night, but the film just ended, and I was like, you know, I was heartbroken that I just wanted to see so much more of them and to see where it's going to go from there. Which, you know, it could be the highest praise you can give a film, and you don't want it to end like that, and I easily could have watched it for hours more.
I have to say, by the end, I had 45 minutes before my next film. I could have happily taken my shoes off and wandered the streets of Bury St Edmunds. I was that romantically drawn in by the three films.
Don't wander Bury barefoot. a final point, and I don't want to be the spectre at the feast here. Who am I kidding? It's the naturalism to me rang false. It felt like it was too over-rehearsed, and it was two well-known actors pretending. I never bought into their relationship for a moment. It just felt like they'd done it several times before, and the shots don't have any meaning to them. The camera just, there's no cinematic beauty or interest. I don't mean there's no compositional skill. There's nothing in this for me.
If I boo you at this point, will I get invited back?
I agree with you in the first half. Like Simon said, I did feel that conversation, it felt quite stilted. It was like, obviously, they introduced these other characters to kind of give other points of view. But no, I just take my hat off to Julie Delpy as well, because I think she gave a really unvain performance.
Yes.
She is not the, you know, Ethan Hawke, if you want to, in a classic way, has probably, he looks a lot better in this film than he did 9 years ago in Before Sunset. He, yeah. You know, and she has aged as women do, and I thought it was a really brave and unvain performance by her, and I applauded her for that, because that is not easy as a woman in Hollywood.
So, I mean, I've got no idea,
yeah,
you know, how much,
go Julie.
How much was scripted, how much was ad-libbed, because they know the characters, and they, you know, they created the characters together, and the three of them wrote it together. But the long takes, especially when they're walking, they are really long takes, with conversation changing three or four times, looking at the most natural conversation.
It, and I do find it lovely to look at.
And it, you know, yeah. They put it in a nice, you got Paris, you got your, you know, it's a nice countryside as well, which always helps.
Doesn't hurt.
Okay. One thing I will say very quickly is you made a comparison on Twitter, Toby, to Certified Copy, the Kiarostami film for a couple of years ago.
Brilliant film, yeah.
To me, that was the one that felt more of a technical achievement, but slightly less human. And that's just maybe different perspectives. You know, this, for me, was a true representation of two people. It's almost the Michael Apted 7-Up, but with fictionalised characters. But in a way, these even feel more real than the real people in that.
All right. OK, well, Before Midnight opened yesterday and is screening at the Arts Picture House Certificate 15. At the moment, the nation's favourite monster veers between the undying romance of vampires and the undead decay of the zombie. Having had vampires last month with a rather excellent Byzantium, now it's the turn of zombies with yesterday's release of World War Z. Starring Brad Pitt, this is the first time Hollywood has thrown a multi-million blockbuster budget at the zombie genre. It's cost the price of a small nation's debt to reenact the end of civilization. Very loosely based on the book by Max Brooks, World War Z begins with a simple mystery virus. Before long, it leaps from animals to human hosts, turning those infected from victim to rampaging monster within a matter of seconds. It's only days before humanity looks to be on the verge of extinction. Pitt stars as UN investigator Jerry Lane, pulled out of retirement and away from his family to risk globe-trotting mission to track down the source of the virus, the patient zero who might yet offer the desperate cure for a hope.
Worldwide. Is anyone doing better than we are?
We've lost the East Coast. Moscow's still dark. Life as we know it will come to an end in 90 days. It's on us to change that.
I can't leave my family.
Don't pretend your family is exempt. When we talk about the end of humanity.
Guns are half measure.
You with the CIA?
Well, they're not with me.
Karen.
Is there anything left out there?
If we knew where this thing started, maybe we could kill it.
I think these things have a weakness.
Every human being we save is one less to fight.
Simon, originally just the... actually, let's cut to the chase. Would this have been a better film if they had not been zombies? It's a zombie film, but their zombies really are only name. They don't have any of the characteristics of the George Romero zombies. Is that a distraction?
They're infected. You know, they're not zombies. They're infected. Is, you know, there is a difference in the term.
But is it leading audiences to go in with unreal expectations of what the film is interested in delivering?
Can I, first of all, before I even start reviewing this, can I just say this has about as much in common with Max Brooks' fantastic World War Z as it has with Hamlet.
Yes.
I really wasn't looking forward to the film because the book's fantastic. This is nothing to do with it, so get that out of the way first. And with that out of the way, it's not a bad film. I've heard a lot of problems with it, and it was quite enjoyable. The interesting take on the infection, the rate of spread, and the zombies come back, it's not really a zombie film. It's not just a slow dread or horror. It is just an action film with lots of, you know, very, very fast running zombies, more like water, and it's interesting, but it falls into so many of the blockbuster traps of idiotic characters, none of it makes sense. You know, it's frustrating, especially when you get things like the lack of blood and gore really got to me in this, not as much other, but when you compare it to things like The Walking Dead on TV,
but they're not zombies,
which is so much more, but they are completely separate. But I mean,
they're not eating people, so there's no real reason for it. I find this whole cacophony that's been mostly on the web about the lack of blood and gore tiresome.
Throughout the most of the film, I agree, it's not much of an issue here, but there's the one scene where he's got the crowbar embedded in a zombie's head, allegedly,
but they completely cut it. So all you can see is him trying to pick a crowbar off the floor with a bit of tension, and it just looks silly. And a lot of the film, there are a lot of unintentional laughs here, where it's funny, but it's not because it's trying to be funny. It's because of ineptness in the script and the way it's been shot. But overall, it's not a bad film.
I quite enjoyed this more. I agree with Simon. I don't think it's a particularly good film, but it's hard for me to damn it in the way I've damned other Star Trek, for instance, because it's trying to, from the most case, it's trying to be something different. And I found the moments it worked were the bits that were unusual. The Mexican boy the boy from the Mexican family that becomes part of their entourage for the rest of the film, the way the Israeli soldier is treated for the rest of the film, even the rewritten, reshot ending, which is completely changes the pace of the film. I found all of that such a relief that I kind of warmed to it despite its ineptitude in many other areas.
Yeah, I think if you go in without massive expectations, there's a lot to take from this. Certainly, there's a lot of actually tense moments in the first couple of sections of the film. It's almost a complete change of pace for the last stretch, and it almost feels like a different film. But again, it's a very watchable film. And Mark Foster does a very effective job of ramping up the tension at certain points. I think you have to put aside the zombie thing. I completely agree with Simon. The Walking Dead is an unfortunate comparison because that's been so effective for HBO. And there's a few moments, not only zombie-related, but also human-related, which happened in the TV series, which happen in the film, and are more effective because of the ability of the TV series to go to those 15 or 18 places that the 12A film can't. It does just feel a bit neutered at certain points.
So we're in a weird world that a television show, which is cable, isn't it? It's not HBO, but it's cable in America.
AMC, yes.
Can be more explicit than the film can.
We have now reached that stage, yes.
Yes. TV audiences can now reach out to any demographic and be selective. Cinema audiences are now trying to rake in as much money as possible and having to pander to the widest possible. Consequently, we're losing the ability as adults to go and see genuine adult blockbuster entertainment.
Yeah, it's one of those strange things when we do see a film and we're saying, I'm really glad that film was an 18 because it's one that actually treats you with intelligence and respect.
But to put this in perspective, I don't like the situation. Walking Dead, the television show, didn't cost $210 million, which is what this film apparently did. You can't risk smaller audience with gore with that amount of money. That's the problem. That's actually the problem Spielberg and Lucas were talking about last week.
You've got the question about why is this film cost $210 million. I've got no idea where that money did actually go.
Read that there's a very interesting Vanity Fair article about where exactly the money went. They bit off more than they could chew.
If we're talking ratings, the American comparisons, it's very much a PG-13. It has been proved you can make money with films that are an R rating, even a hard R rating, sort of 15 rating as we have.
But can you make
here.
Money in China? That plays a point. China's the second biggest audience for Hollywood blockbusters, but is it for an 18? So these are the things they have to take into account if they're spending that much money on a film. One final point, because we really have to wrap up. This isn't a great film, but I think what makes it a much more interesting film is if just imagine exactly the same story, but made by Roland Emmerich. And that shines a much more favourable light on the strengths of World War Z. I enjoyed Brad Pitt. I enjoyed bits of it a lot.
The first hour was good, but then it just gets into silly territory.
It does do silly things, but then it keeps an eye on the small moments, I think, which these films don't tend to.
And given that we've had at least two summer blockbusters that have done stupid in a big way this summer, to have something that's just silly is actually a nice change of pace.
Oh, aren't we lucky? Okay, you're right. What a depressing statistic. Okay, World War Z opened yesterday and is screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is Certificate 15. That is all we have time for on the show today. Every word will be available to listen again via the Cambridge 105 podcast, which will be up in a few days. Please visit our website, www.cambridge105, for more details, including the option to catch up with all our programmes for the last few months and to get an idea of the rich schedule we have here on Community Radio for Cambridge. We'll be back on July the 6th with an all-new show that will feature magic horror robbery, and yet more ending of the world. We'll have Now You See Me, which is a magical caper comedy. We have This Is the End with Hollywood A-listers facing the end of the world. I'm rewriting my script in my head. And we have Kill List director Ben Wheatley's new film, A Field in England. We'll end proceedings with more Superman, though in this case a chance to play Laurie Anderson's unlikely chart-topping hit from 1981. Please stay tuned from Radio Dante, from everybody here on Bums on Seats. Goodbye.
Goodbye.